exposed to the early autumn chill, we play New England's favorite outdoor social game, seeing who will be the first to break and beg to go back inside. The food stamps program, he says instantly, when I ask him for his biggest concern. The Trump budget had proposed cutting food stamps by more than 25% over the next 10 years, and more or less abandoning the notion that the country should provide some minimum level of nutrition to its citizens. The Trump budget was just an opening bid, and unlikely to become policy, at least not right away, because Congress could always fight it. But it signaled an intention and, perhaps, a shift in public attitude. Why is it that people channel so many of their hang-ups about people who are poor or unsuccessful into the food stamps program? Asks Guncannon as we settle into our chairs, then answers his own question. No one really knows when you go to the doctor and the government is paying, but people see you with this card or coupon and react. People would say to me, I saw someone buying butter with food stamps. And I would say, well, yes. Anyone who takes over his old job, he explains, needs to be especially vigilant about fraud, even though there is probably less of it in the program than ever. Actual fraud in the food stamp program in 2015 was about 5% of the $70 billion paid out. People still succeed in understating their income and get benefits they would otherwise not. People occasionally traffic, the term of art for exchanging food stamps at less than face value, for cash or ineligible goods. The store owner then puts through a bunch of phony purchases and pockets the difference between what the government pays him and what he has paid to the food stamper. And fraud is far more likely in some parts of the country than in others. The Dakotas, they're all Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts who live there, Guncannon says. But just look at Miami or Columbus, Ohio. But replacing food stamps with a card that has a PIN has made fraud and theft much less common. The USDA hires specialists to search food purchase data for suspicious patterns. When they find what appears to be a problem, they send in one of the 100 USDA food stamp undercover investigators to gather evidence. I stop writing and look up. The Department of Agriculture has private eyes? They're more like Columbos, he says. But that's not his point, he says. His point is that, while actual fraud is relatively rare, instances of fraud attract huge media attention and can have big effects, like Surfer Dude. Surfer Dude was a guy in San Diego who claimed on Fox News that the food stamp program gave him the cushion he needed to surf all day. The network ate it up. And that was the problem. The distorting media coverage of any cheating creates political resistance to the entire enterprise. No one in the Trump administration was likely to ever come right out and say, "We want to let kids and old people go hungry." But obviously, they might run the program so ineptly that it lost political support. And then kids and old people would go hungry. What I needed to keep in mind, said Concannon, was just how much was at stake for the people who needed the program. I used to tell the people that worked for me, you may not ever meet a single person it benefits. You might never see the infants who are fed, or that family that lost a job. To the extent you can keep in mind that they are out there, it will motivate you to do your job better. It now occurs to me that this question of motivation sits somewhere near the middle of the problem I am investigating. Why does someone go to work inside this little box, or any little box inside the federal government? There's always an answer to this question, and it's obviously important. Why a person does what he does has a big effect on how he does it, and yet, Kevin Concannon, whose little box had spent nearly $1 trillion, had never really been asked it. He has an answer to the question, as it turns out. He'd grown up in Portland, Maine, in a working-class family with 7 children. His older brother had suffered from schizophrenia. His parents, immigrants from Ireland, had been crippled by the sense that they were responsible for their child's illness. There was a very strong belief in those days in nurture versus nature, he says. Then one day, like a bolt from the blue, a pair of social workers from the Veterans Administration visited their home. They put his brother on a new medication which eased his symptoms. They helped my parents to understand that the fact that he had this illness had nothing whatever to do with how they raised him, says Concannon. It was the luck of the draw. The effect of these government angels on his family's life was astonishing. By the time Concannon left for college in 1959, He wondered what it might be like to do that kind of work. In college, he read The Other America, Michael Harrington's account of the lives of the American poor, and listened to John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech with its bracing call to public service. By the time he graduated, he knew what he wanted to be. 14 years later, he was running Maine's mental health services. He proved effective enough at the job that, after an election pushed him out of it, other states recruited him. In 1987, he took a job running the mental health and developmental disabilities programs for Oregon. 4 months into his new gig, Oregon's governor, Neil Goldschmidt, grabbed him in the hallway. He said, "Come on to the press room. They're naming the new director of human services," I said. "Who is it?" And he says, "It's you." As the head of Oregon's nutrition programs, he learned that the country's willingness to feed people who are hungry does not mean that hungry people are always fed. The federal government makes the benefits available, but then leaves it to states to administer them. "Where you live in this country makes a huge difference if you are poor," says Concannon. "And it's not just the weather. You have states with these 60 or 70 page documents people have to fill out to get benefits. Poor people are easy to wear down." Georgia was usually a problem. Texas, too. "If they ran any of their football teams the way they run their food program, they'd fire the coach," said Concannon. A Wyoming legislator, proud of how badly he had gummed up the state's nutrition programs, told him, "We pride ourselves on doing the minimum required by the federal government." An Arizona congressman proposed that the card used by people receiving food stamp benefits be made prison orange, conferring not just nutrition but shame. In 2016, after several counties in North Carolina suffered severe flooding, the state tried to distribute federal disaster relief food benefit cards on the day of the presidential election to give poor people a choice between eating and voting. In Kansas, Concannon had explained to an executive who oversaw the state's food stamp program how he had made it easier for people in Oregon who were going hungry to access their program. He said, "Geez, if we did that, we'd have more people coming in the door." And I said, "Yeah, but isn't that the idea?" Concannon viewed his job in Oregon simply, to make benefits more easily available to people who qualified for them. Minimize the red tape, promote the programs, change the culture that dispensed them from one of suspicion to one of sympathy. From Oregon, at the behest of yet another governor, he returned home to Maine to run all of the public health and nutrition programs. There he displayed yet again his unusual gift for finding and slacking need. For instance, he noticed that a lot of people without health insurance in the state were failing to fill their prescriptions because they couldn't afford the drugs. In northern Maine, people were crossing the border into Canada, where they could buy the same drugs from the same companies at a fraction of the cost. He thought the situation both outrageous and economically inefficient. Help people prevent a stroke, and you could avoid the far greater expense of caring for them after they had one. He created a program, Maine RX, that extended the cheaper Medicaid prices of drugs to people who were well above the poverty line. Within 3 months, 100,000 people had signed up. The drug companies challenged the program, taking it all the way to the Supreme Court, which mandated some changes. It's now called Maine RX Plus. In 2003, at the request of Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, he left Maine for Iowa. In his 6 years there, he raised the number of Iowans receiving food stamps by 68%. There was more, but it was getting late. "Are you cold?" I ask, hopefully. "No," he says, "but if you are." We move back inside to his kitchen table. He locates a plate of freshly baked banana bread and puts it in front of me. I try not to stare at it. Dry banana bread I find inedible. Moist, sticky banana bread I find hard to resist. His banana bread glistens. There are people who would seek to dismiss his entire enterprise with a single line. "Why should my hard-earned dollars go to feed anyone else?" They'd see Kevin Concannon as the king of handouts, a promoter of sloth and indolence. But the facts of the program he ran for 8 years are innocent. Its average benefit is just $1.40 a meal. 87% of that money goes to households with children, the disabled, and elderly. The idea that we are going to put these people to work is nonsense. Able-bodied adults on food stamps are required to work or attend job training for at least 20 hours a week. The nation's private food banks dispense about $8 billion in food each year, while $70 billion in food is provided through food stamps. Private charity alone will not feed everyone who needs feeding. The problem with the program is not that people are cheating it. The problem with the program is that people who should be on it are not. Kevin Concannon had done a lot to fix it. He'd raised the participation rate of the poor people who qualified for it from 72% to 85%, and he'd reduced fraud rates to all-time lows. But the myths about the food stamp program, that food stamps can be used in casinos or to buy alcohol and tobacco, for instance, persisted. I reach for a slice of banana bread. "Anything else you worried about?" I ask. "School nutrition," he says, without missing a beat. 1 week after being sworn in, Sonny Perdue staged a public event at a school in Leesburg, Virginia. The Obama administration had pushed successfully to raise the nutritional requirements of school meals fed to 30 million American schoolchildren for the first time in 20 years. To receive federal subsidies for the meals they serve, schools are now required to behave more like responsible parents than indifferent ones. More whole grains, more fruits and vegetables, less sodium, no artificially sweetened whole milk, and so on. Concannon expanded the breakfast programs for kids who did not get fed at home, and that meal too became more nutritious. "You can't just serve them pancakes and hot dogs," he says. Big companies that provided the schools with meals fought back. It was more profitable for them to serve pancakes and hot dogs than fruits and vegetables. But by the end of 2016, America's children were eating better than they had been in 2008. 98% of the schools were meeting the new standards, says Concannon. And to those that weren't, that had some problem, we'd say, "We'll work with you." At the school in Leesburg, Perdue announced that the USDA would no longer require schools to meet the whole grain standard, or the new sodium standard, or ban fat in artificially sweetened milk. Those changes sound trivial, but the stakes are huge. This is a matter not just of what kind of milk America's school children drink, but also of the process by which we as a society decide which milk they will drink. Will it be driven by the dairy industry and the snack food industry, or by nutritionists? Concannon was deeply disappointed in Perdue's speech. He saw it as pure politics, not motivated by any concern for children's welfare. "Look, you can have confidence in the career people," he said, "because most of them have migrated to where they are out of desire. They believe in what they are doing." About the new political people who might replace him, he wasn't so sure. The problem was motive. Why would they come to work at the USDA? A person who worked inside Concannon's little box, as long as they catered to the food industry, could make a lot more money outside of it. Munching on a second slice of banana bread, I look around Concannon's house. His career was over. He'd spent the better part of 50 years using public money to alleviate suffering. He'd controlled nearly $1 trillion in government spending. Yet his home is modest. He drives a 10-year-old Volvo. He had gone from state to state, and each time he had been honored for his public service. The plaques were stacked up in his garage. He didn't own enough wall space for them all. What's striking about Kevin Concannon is what he decided, for whatever reason, he didn't need. He could have named his price with the drug and food company lobbies, and yet he'd never taken a job in the private sector. He claims never to have felt the slightest interest in that kind of work. "I've done all right," he says when I ask him, more or less, why he's not rich. "I've always had enough. I've never felt the need to go over to the other side and make 3 times the amount of money. If you like what you do, you just keep doing it." On my way out the door, he stops me. "You didn't ask me what else I was worried about," he said. "But if you asked me, I'd say science." The thing you eventually noticed about Kathy Wotecki was her detachment. She was slow to talk about the more emotionally charged moments of her career, and even when she did, she didn't talk for long. It wasn't until our 4th conversation, for instance, that she bothered to mention she had become an agricultural scientist, only after her professors told her that there was no place for women in basic science. She'd graduated in 1969 from Mary Washington College, the women's affiliate of the University of Virginia, which at the time didn't accept women as undergraduates. From there, she followed her future husband to Virginia Tech, where she entered the graduate program in biochemistry. Her fellow graduate students in science were all men. It took her a while to sense how the professors treated her differently from the way they did everyone else. I finally figured it out when all the guys were given assistantships and I wasn't. She went to the head of the department and asked what she needed to do to get an assistantship too. He said I would not be given one because women were a poor investment. I'd probably only have children and drop out. Looking back, she found it odd that they had let her into the school only to stifle her ambition. But it was the late 1960s, and people were making new, if half-hearted, attempts to address sex discrimination. If you talk to women scientists of my age, almost all of them have a story similar to mine, she says. Virginia Tech, like most every college in the United States with Tech or A&M after its name, was established in the wake of an 1862 law passed by the same Congress that created the Department of Agriculture. In the middle of the Civil War, Lincoln had decided it was time to make U.S. agriculture more efficient. Each person not needed on the farm was another person freed up to do something else. That's why the Department of Agriculture was created in the first place, as a vast science lab. Endless statistics illustrate the astonishing effects that lab has had. It has changed the way we live. In 1872, the average American farmer fed roughly 4 other people. Now the average farmer feeds about 155 other people. It's not just people and plants that have become more productive. In 1950, the average cow yielded 5,300 pounds of milk. In 2016, the average cow yielded 23,000 pounds of milk. A Wisconsin Holstein recently yielded nearly 75,000 pounds of milk in a year, which amounts to roughly 24 gallons a day. Her name is Gigi. You can thank her later. Changes in agricultural science trigger changes in the structure of the society, where people live, what they do, what they value, the metaphors that naturally pop into their minds. Those changes have been driven by research funded by the Department of Agriculture, done inside the land-grant colleges created alongside it. Virginia Tech, like the University of Wisconsin, was one of the original ones. Because Virginia Tech was a land-grant university, there was a department called Human Nutrition, which I had never heard of as a field of study, says Wotecki. She ended up studying the subject because that was what she was encouraged to study. She had no particular connection to farming or agriculture. Her father had been an Air Force fighter pilot. She'd grown up on military bases. The first time I ever touched a cow, she said, was when I artificially inseminated one at Virginia Tech. But she grew interested in the intersection between food and health. Her dissertation investigated a mysterious outbreak of illness in Texas where, in the late 1960s, Mexican-American kids were turning up sick and no one could figure out why. She figured out why. Milk. It wasn't a pathogen, she said. It was the lactose in the milk. Mexican-Americans, as a group, turned out to be especially intolerant of it, though no one had known that until that moment. The symptoms usually started by age 11 or 12. She became a professor of human nutrition at an interesting moment. In the early 1970s, Congress was taking a new interest in malnutrition in children. There was a lot of stunting and wasting in children, she recalls. After a talk given by a congressional staffer studying the effects of legislation on human nutrition, she walked up and introduced herself, and he hired her on the spot. One thing led to another, and soon she was leading a group inside the Department of Agriculture that took survey data and analyzed patterns in food consumption to explore the relationships between the American diet and American disease. From there, she moved naturally enough to the Centers for Disease Control, where she led a team seeking answers to basic questions about the overall health of the population. For instance, blood lead levels in children fell by a lot in the 1970s and early 1980s. This welcome development, they figured out, was due to the phasing out of leaded gasoline. In early 1993, a pediatrician in Seattle alerted the Washington State Department of Health that he was seeing in children symptoms of E. coli, such as cramps and bloody diarrhea. In 4 western states, hundreds of people became seriously ill. 4 children died. The disease was tracked to Jack in the Box. The chain had been cooking its hamburgers at temperatures too low to kill the bacteria. The Department of Agriculture is responsible for the safety of all meat. The FDA handles all other food. An American killed by his spinach can justifiably blame the FDA, but an American killed by his steak is the responsibility of the Department of Agriculture. Cheese pizzas are the FDA's problem. Pepperoni pizzas are supervised by the USDA. After the Jack in the Box outbreak, the USDA created a new little box on the organizational chart called Food Safety. Wotecki became its first undersecretary and served in the post for 4 years. After that, she thought she was done with government. Then 9/11 happened, she said. I had an emotional response. What can I do? It made me realize there were very few people who had ever had the experiences I had had. She was able to explain the various threats to the food supply as few could, for example. She understood how genetic engineering might be used as a weapon of mass destruction. She knew that a microbe could bring down a civilization. She returned to government. For the last 6 years of the Obama administration, she'd been the Department of Agriculture's chief scientist. The same qualities that had led her to minimize the importance of her feelings had made her an excellent supervisor of science. Though she didn't seem to care one way or another how she was addressed, no one thought of her as Kathy. She was always Dr. Wotecki. She was great at her job, said Tom Vilsack. She was very adamant about keeping politics out of science. If I called and said, how about we delay the announcement of that grant for a week or so, it was, hands off my science. We don't really celebrate the accomplishments of government employees. They exist in our society to take the blame. But if anyone ever paid attention, they would note that Wotecki's department, among other achievements, had suppressed the potentially catastrophic 2015 outbreak of bird flu. They'd created very quickly a fast new test for the disease that enabled them to cull the sick chickens from the healthy ones. Because of their work, the poultry industry was forced to kill only tens of millions of birds instead of hundreds of millions. In the early 1990s, the USDA had also dealt with the outbreak of ring spot virus in papaya trees, when the papaya industry in Hawaii faced ruin and extinction. Inside the little box marked Science, the USDA helped genetically engineer a papaya tree that was resistant to ring spot virus. The worst I could get anyone to say about Kathy Wotecki was that she had an unusual sense of humor, at least by the careful standards of the Department of Agriculture. The jokes of scientists sometimes feel like experiments gone wrong, and she was very much a scientist. Her car license plate read, Dr. Woe. No one at the USDA called her that or could imagine doing so. At Secretary Vilsack's small office Christmas dinner for top USDA officials, Kathy's scientist husband came wearing an elf hat. No one knew why, says a USDA staffer. She had looked at her husband, dressed as an elf, and said, yep, that'll work. She never explained it. It was actually kind of endearing. The first time we spoke wasn't long after Trump had nominated her replacement. His name was Sam Clovis. He had a doctorate in public administration from the University of Alabama, but no experience in science. He'd come to prominence in 2010 as a Rush Limbaugh-style right-wing talk radio host in Sioux City, Iowa. As Iowa chairman of Rick Perry's 2016 presidential campaign, he'd ripped Trump loudly and righteously for having no foundation in Christ. Then he'd quit Perry's campaign to become co-chairman of the Trump campaign, declining to address rumors he'd done it for the money. I'm not going to talk about how much money I'm getting paid, he told the Des Moines Register. It's just not going to happen. His appointment as the USDA's chief scientist felt like a practical joke to those who had worked there. This was the place that, back in the early 1940s, had taken Alexander Fleming's findings and effectively invented penicillin. It had triggered the antibiotics revolution. It had coped with blights and outbreaks. The consequences of the science it funded or did not fund was mind-boggling. The person Clovis was replacing had taught at universities, worked in the White House, and, along the way, been elected to the National Academy of Sciences. They're going to politicize the science, said Wotecki. My biggest concern is the misuse of science to support policies. In recent years, much of the department's research has dealt with the effects of climate change. The head of science directs nearly $3 billion in grants each year. Wotecki directed the science that leads to nutritional standards for school children. She set research priorities, Hers had been food security, domestic and global nutrition, safety of the food supply, and figuring out how best to convert plants into fuel. All of that has to be done in the face of a changing climate, said Wotecki. It's all climate change. It might sound silly that the USDA funds a project that seeks to improve the ability of sheep to graze at high altitudes, until you realize that this may one day be the only place sheep will be able to graze. We're going to become even more reliant on the efficiencies that come from the investment in science, she said. One quarter of the arable land in the world is already degraded, either by overfarming or overgrazing. Changing temperatures and changing rainfall patterns will force changes in the way crops are grown and livestock are raised, she said. The changing climate brings new risks of foodborne disease. Even the pathogens are influenced by temperature and humidity. If the Trump administration were to pollute the scientific inquiry of the USDA with politics, scientific inquiry would effectively cease. These high-level discussions really worry me, she says. Research grants will go not to the most promising ideas, but to the closest allies. There is already good science that isn't being funded, she said. That will get worse. Junk science will be used to muddy issues like childhood nutrition. Maybe sodium isn't as bad for kids as people say. There's no such thing as too much sugar. The science will suddenly be unclear. There will no longer be truth and falsehood. There will just be stories with two sides to them. Since she had run two of the little boxes on the org chart, I decided to kill two birds with one stone and ask Wotecki what most worried her about food safety. Regulatory reform and food safety without science, she said. That was too general. I pressed her for some real specific concern. They could increase the line speeds, she said, without having to think. The USDA has big, fat, quite readable rule books to prevent meat from killing people. One rule concerns the speed of the poultry slaughter lines, 140 birds a minute. In theory, some poor USDA inspector is meant to physically examine each and every bird for defects. But obviously, no human being can inspect 140 birds a minute. No industry can kill 9 billion birds each year without wanting to find faster ways to do it. In the fall of 2017, the National Chicken Council petitioned the USDA to allow for line speeds of 175 or faster. It'll make it even harder for inspectors to do their jobs, says Wotecki. The petition, at least for now, stands rejected. What she fears isn't so much the bad intentions of the people who filled the jobs she once did. She fears their seeming commitment to scientific ignorance. No big chicken company wants to poison a bunch of children with salmonella, but if you speed up the slaughter lines, you need to make the new speed safe. Ignorance allows people to disregard the consequences of their actions, and sometimes it leads to consequences even they did not intend. Ali Zaidi drew a distinction between the little boxes inside the Department of Agriculture that enforced regulation, such as food safety, and those that spent money, such as science. One is the stick and the other is the carrot, he said. You pay for things often that you can't or won't regulate. Where the government had the power to regulate, it had less need to pay for things. It couldn't compel university professors to do agricultural research, and so it paid them to do it. It had the power to compel, say, egg producers to adhere to rules that kept eggs from making people sick, and so didn't need to pay them to do it. In the extreme case, the federal government could just buy eggs for everyone and test all of these eggs, said Zaidi. That's obviously a dumb thing to do from an economic point of view. But it shows you how regulation takes the place of expenditure. The regulation side of things is, as a rule, less vulnerable to the short-term idiocy of a new administration than the money side of things. The big show Trump has made of removing regulations by executive order has done far less than he suggests, as there is a formal rule-changing process. You must solicit outside opinion, wait a certain amount of time for those opinions to arrive, and then deal with the inevitable legal challenges to your rule change. To increase the number of chickens a poultry company murders each minute might take years, even if it is the smart thing to do. But to change who gets money to do agricultural research, or whether they get it at all, is a cinch. For that reason, Ali thought the little box marked science was a far greater concern than the box marked food safety. There were two other important little boxes inside the USDA. One was marked Farm, and the other was Rural Development. Ali Zaidi had watched many billions flow through the first and a few billion flow through the second. He thought it highly unlikely the Trump administration's budget cuts would have much effect on the farm dollars. A lot of that money went to big grain producers, the same Republican senators from farm states who said they abhorred government spending of almost any sort, became radical socialists when the conversation turned to handouts to big grain producers. The money follows the political power of the constituencies, said Ali, instead of the evidence of need in America. If you really boil down the difference between the farm side of the budget and the rural development side of the budget, the farm subsidies can wind up in the pockets of large corporations. It's the rural development money that tends to stay in these communities. Without that money, he thought, rural America would be a very different place than it is. Without the USDA's money, it's possible we'd look like sub-Saharan Africa or rural China, said Ali. Much of small-town America is dispersed and disorganized and poor. The people in those communities don't have the money to hire Washington lobbyists. Yet a way of life depends on the sort of federal subsidies only a powerful lobbyist might procure. It's preserving an emotional infrastructure, said Ali. We have decided this is the type of community we want to preserve. But the entire time I was in the White House, we grappled with the question, where do we find the political capital for rural development? Because it can't just come from the people rural development helps. By the time she left the little box marked Rural Development, Lillian Salerno had spent the better part of 5 years inside it. The box's function was simple, to channel low-interest rate loans, along with a few grants, mainly to towns with fewer than 50,000 people in them. Her department ran the $220 billion bank that serviced the poorest of the poor in rural America, in the Deep South, and in the tribal lands, and in the communities called colonias, along the U.S.-Mexico border. Some of the communities in the South, the only checks going in are government checks, she said. And yet, amazingly, they nearly always repaid their loans. Half her job had been vetting the demands from rural America for help. The other half had been one long, unglamorous road trip. It wasn't like I could just fly to New York City. I'd be going to, like, Minco, Oklahoma. Everywhere I went was two flights minimum plus a 2 or 3 hour drive. On the other end of the trip lay some small town in dire need of a health center or housing or a small business. You go through these small towns and you see these ridiculously nice fire stations. That's us, she said. It was always more expensive for these towns to get electricity and internet access and health care. But for the federal government, rural Alaska wouldn't have any drinking water. The need was incredible. Her work felt urgent. We give $40,000 for a health clinic, and the whole time you're like, shit, this makes a difference. As the USDA's loans were usually made through local banks, the people on the receiving end of them were often unaware of where the money was coming from. There were many stories very like the one Tom Vilsack told about a loan they had made in Minnesota to a government shade-throwing, Fox News-watching, small-town businessman. The bank held a ceremony, and the guy wound up being interviewed by the local paper. He's telling the reporter how proud he is to have done it on his own, said Vilsack. The USDA person goes to introduce herself, and he says, so who are you? She says, I'm the USDA person. He asks, what are you doing here? She says, well, sir, we supplied the money you were announcing. He was white as a sheet. Salerno saw this sort of thing all the time. We'd have this check, said Salerno. We'd blow it up and try to have a picture taken with it. It said, United States Government in great big letters. That was something that Vilsack wanted, to be right out in front so people knew the federal government had helped them. In the red southern states, the mayor sometimes would say, can you not mention that the government gave this? Even when it was saving lives or preserving communities, the government remained oddly invisible. It's just a misunderstanding of the system, said Salerno. We don't teach people what government actually does. She herself hadn't learned until very late. She'd grown up in a family with no money and 9 children, and Republican sympathies, in a small farming town in Texas called Little Elm. Her graduating high school class had 18 people in it. She was both student council president and head cheerleader. The reason I'm not very good at math is you had to choose, cheerleading or math, and I chose cheerleading. Few of her school's graduates ever went to college, but she was admitted to the University of Texas on a Pell Grant. She paid for what the grant didn't by waiting tables. She was waiting tables in Little Elm in the late 1980s when friends started getting sick and dying from AIDS. She went to Dallas to visit them. There, at a hospital, she saw that men condemned to death were going without care. The nurses were frightened to interact with them. They had a particular fear of being infected by the needles that delivered medication to the patients. "At that time, everyone died," said Salerno. "And they are told, the nurses aren't coming." I said, "That's about as fucked as anything I ever saw." She had a raw sense of injustice and a desire to see life be made fair. Small town, big family, no resources. You look at the world in a certain way. She also had a roll-up-your-sleeves-and-fix-it attitude. After seeing the needless suffering, she came up with an idea, the retractable needle. It worked like a ballpoint pen. A friend of hers, an engineer, designed it. She applied to the local community bank for a loan and got it. It wasn't until much later that she discovered that the loan had ultimately come from the Small Business Administration and that the federal government had simply used the local bank as a delivery system. She didn't know enough to know that no bank was going to lend money to a first-time entrepreneur on the strength of a new invention, in part because banks didn't value willpower. "All good inventions come from something personal," she said. "People create things because it's personal." Salerno and her partner built and ran the new company in Little Elm and called it Retractable Technologies. They received their first patent in the early 1990s and FDA approval in 1997. The first year in business, they sold 1 million syringes, the next year, 3 million. By the third year, her company employed 140 people in Little Elm. She repaid the bank her government loan, and she still didn't realize it was a government loan. For the first time in her life, she had money. She also now had a view of the inner workings of the healthcare industry. The company that had made the old syringes, Becton Dickinson and Company, controlled more than 80% of the market and felt threatened. It wasn't long before Becton started to require hospital systems to buy its clumsy new version of a safe syringe by bundling it with other products. Salerno assumed Becton was counting on her inability to pay for the lawsuits required to fight them. But she did, and wound up with a settlement of $100 million in 2004. Even then, Becton found ways to keep her new product from gaining full access to the market. Her company survived but didn't become what it might have. It now employs 130 people instead of the 200 at its peak. Salerno concluded that increased corporate power was one of the forces that had reduced the opportunity available in rural America. The rapacity of companies with monopolistic power and their ability to have their way with the government got her thinking about the big American systems. "The entire health industry lies about what things cost to make," she said. "I know what things cost because I made them." Her outrage led her to support Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign in 2007, but she soon switched to Obama. "I switched because I got so angry at how they were beating him up." After Obama won, Salerno was a natural candidate for a job she had no idea existed, helping people in rural America to help themselves. Someone said, "Why don't you become an administrator in rural America at the Department of Agriculture?" I said, "There's an administrator in rural America?" She'd come to her job inside the little box marked Rural Development without any particular ambition to be there. The sums of money at her disposal were incredible. The little box gave out or guaranteed $30 billion in loans and grants a year. But people who should have known about it hadn't the first clue what it was up to. "I had this conversation with elected and state officials almost everywhere in the South," said Salerno. "Them, we hate the government and you suck, me. My mission alone put $1 billion into your economy this year, so are you sure about that?" Me thinking, "We're the only reason your shitty state is standing." She was a small business person first, and had no affection for the inefficiencies she found inside the federal government. "You have this big federal workforce that hasn't been invested in forever," she said. "They can't be outward-facing. They don't have any of the tools you need in a modern workplace." She couldn't attract young people to work there. Once, she tried to estimate how many of the USDA's 100,000 employees had been taught how to create a spreadsheet. Fewer than 50 people, she decided. "I was always very aware how we spent money. when I would use words like fiduciary duties or say, those are not our dollars, they would say, are you sure you aren't a Republican? But I was really sensitive to the fact that this wasn't our money. This was taxpayer money. This was money that had come from some guy working for 15 bucks an hour. The big, messy federal government was still the only tool for dealing with what she saw as a growing crisis, the deconstruction of rural America. It's hard to quantify what it means not to have your entire town's businesses shuttered up because Walmart moved there, she said. There was a hole in the American capital markets. They simply didn't reach small towns. And there were lots of stats that suggested that society benefited from having small towns, and that small-town life made some important, perhaps undervalued, contributions to the whole. 15% of the country lives in towns of fewer than 10,000 people, for instance, but a far greater proportion of the armed services come from rural areas than from urban ones. But the more rural the American, the more dependent he is for his way of life on the U.S. government. And the more rural the American, the more likely he was to have voted for Donald Trump. So you might think that Trump, when he took office, would do everything he could to strengthen and grow the little box marked rural development. That's not what has happened. The Trump administration wanted to show early that it was serious about foreign trade. This desire expressed itself in the Department of Agriculture by a splitting of the little box marked Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services into two little boxes, one for farm programs and another for foreign agricultural affairs or trade. Oddly, at that very moment, Trump was removing the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and costing American farmers an estimated $4.4 billion a year in foreign sales, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. As there's a rule against having more than seven little boxes on the USDA's org chart, they had to eliminate one of the little boxes. The little box they got rid of was rural development. I worked in the little box in the government most responsible for helping people who elected Trump, said Salerno, and they literally took my little box off the organization chart. This troubled Lillian Salerno, and not just because she'd spent 5 years of her life inside that little box. It troubled her because it made her wonder about the motives of the people who had taken over the Department of Agriculture. She'd worked inside the little box for a reason. And if you wanted to understand what was at stake inside these little boxes, you could not neglect the motives of the people who ran them. You want to know what worries me most? She says after I ask her the question I'd come to ask her. I am absolutely convinced about one thing. There are conversations going on right now in New York and Washington between people in the Trump administration and Wall Street bankers about how to get their hands on the bank portfolio. Folks in banking, I'm sure they are nice people. They just can't help themselves. She's worried that an only partially adequate tool for helping people who were raised in the country's unlucky places will be turned into a source of profits for the biggest financial firms. She thinks that was why they eliminated her little box and moved the $220 billion bank into the office of the secretary, so they could do new things with the money without people noticing. At the end of the day, what do I think they are going to do? She said. Take all the money and give it to their banker friends. Do things like privatize water, so people in rural Florida will be paying $75 a month for it instead of $20. Lillian Salerno had observed the Trump administration for a long moment. Virtually all the people Trump had sent into the Department of Agriculture were white men in their 20s. They exhibited no knowledge of or interest in the problems of rural Americans. She decided there was only one thing to do. Move back to Texas and run for office. She had no illusions about herself as a political candidate. She was still a small-town girl from Little Elm, Texas. I'm still basically a waitress, she said. I still feel like this. If I get to be a congressman, I'll still feel like that. Ali Zaidi had asked a question. Where would the political capital come from to help people in rural America? Well, it would come from her. Zaidi marveled at how hard it was for Americans to see the source of their society's strength. People who came to the United States from other countries had this one advantage. They didn't take it for granted. The immigrant journey has a time compression to it, he said. Within a generation, you're able to see how the rungs of the ladder of opportunity are laid out in front of you, and you can see the hands that pull you up. You see people pull you up and you say, okay, I've got to do the same thing for other people. I came up that ladder of opportunity, but even I didn't know the names of the government programs that made up the ladder itself. Growing up, what was obvious to me was the kindness of community members, but government was less visible. You need to work really hard to appreciate it. And who wants to do that? Chapter 3. All the President's Data. As she walked the path that the tornado had torn through the American town, she was struck by how hard it would have been to imagine what she was now seeing. 2 days earlier, on May 22, 2011, the wind had cleaved Joplin, Missouri in two, leaving behind a lot of you-have-to-see-it-to-believe-it stuff. A rubber hose run entirely through a tree trunk, a chair sideways, all four legs piercing a wall, a giant Walmart tractor trailer thrown 200 yards onto the top of what had been the Pepsi building, a full-size SUV folded in half around a tree. The metal had been flayed from the car, and the tree was no longer a tree but a tree trunk, as all the branches had snapped and blown away. I felt like some giant had taken an egg beater and run it through a town, said Kathy Sullivan. It was toothpicks. Then she realized that the egg beater metaphor was not exactly right, as the edges of the destruction were eerily undisturbed. What the tornado had narrowly missed was as perfectly preserved as what it had hit was perfectly eliminated. It was like when you run your finger through the icing on top of a cake, she said. A clean line of total destruction. Doctors in the local emergency rooms were seeing trauma they'd never seen. Body parts strewn on the ground outside the hospital. A small child back stripped of flesh right down to the bone. They could count his vertebrae. People impaled by street signs. People with wounds that looked as if they were caused by automatic rifles, except that the objects deep inside them were not bullets. Seriously injured people had driven themselves to the hospital with dead loved ones in their car and apologized to the hospital staff. They didn't know what else to do with the bodies. Tornado outbreaks in the middle of the United States that spring had killed more than 500 people. In Joplin alone, 158 people had died, and thousands had been injured, many critically. That was more than had been killed by a single tornado since the U.S. government had taken on the job of warning people about them. In and of itself, this was shocking, but to Kathy Sullivan it was especially so. These people had been informed. The warnings from the National Weather Service, which would soon be reporting to her, had been even better this time than they usually were. The initial tornado watch had come 4 hours before the event, but then a tornado watch is different from a tornado warning. The average National Weather Service tornado warning comes 13 minutes before a tornado strikes. Joplin's sirens had sounded the warning 17 minutes before the tornado touched down and 19 minutes before it entered Joplin. But the citizens of Joplin had ignored it. The majority of surveyed Joplin residents did not immediately go to shelter upon hearing the initial warning, as the report Sullivan would soon oversee noted. One day, someone will write the history of the strange relationship between the United States government and its citizens. It would need at least a chapter on the government's attempts to save the citizens from the things that might kill them. The first successful tornado prediction was made on an Air Force base in Norman, Oklahoma, in 1948. The men who made it had been lucky. They wouldn't be able to do it again. Knowing this, the government had taken the view that people were better off not being warned. The Weather Bureau, as it was then called, was banned from using the word tornado. It just frightened people, the Bureau believed. But word got out. The government meteorologists had this mysterious new skill, and people demanded to hear what they had to say, even if what they had to say was of little value. Since then, the government meteorologists had gotten better at their jobs. The billions of dollars they'd spent on satellites, radar, computing power, and better forecast models had led to, among other things, truly useful tornado warnings. And yet people didn't seem to realize that the government's weather information was more and more reliable, or even that it was their government giving it to them. It no longer shocked Kathy Sullivan to hear otherwise educated citizens say that they got their weather from the Weather Channel, or some app on their phone. a United States congressman had asked her why the taxpayer needed to fund the National Weather Service when he could get his weather from AccuWeather. Where on earth did he think AccuWeather, or the apps, or the Weather Channel got their weather? Where was AccuWeather when winds of 200 and something miles per hour were churning through an American town, killing people? Clearly, citizens didn't understand their government. But that had been true for some time. Now Kathy saw that the government didn't really understand its citizens either. Why had they not saved themselves? If anyone should know the answer to that question, it was Kathy herself, and she had no clue. In some curious way, the United States government had a better handle on the weather than on its own people. It had spent billions of dollars to collect data about the weather, and none about how people responded to it. She could not help but admire the people of Joplin. Walking through the ruins, she saw all over again what she had seen so many times, how much better Americans were at responding to a disaster than preventing it. Everybody who could was pitching in to help. The border of the devastated area looked like a tailgater at a college football game. The people who had been spared were cooking food for the people who had not. "No one asked questions," said Kathy. "No one asked if your home had been destroyed. If you walked up and said you were hungry, you got food." No one could say she hadn't done her job. She was not by nature or upbringing a political person, but her ambition had led her to become one. She had made all the little compromises, done all the little deals with others and with herself, required to survive in the upper reaches of American government. She was now second in command, and soon to be first, at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. NOAA oversaw the National Weather Service, among other things. The National Weather Service had seen the tornado and had issued a warning. Her people had given these people what they needed to survive. And yet on May 22, 2011, more Americans had been killed by a single tornado than on any day in the past 64 years. She might have said nothing, just thrown up her hands in the privacy of her office and told herself that it wasn't her job to save people from their own stupidity. Instead, she asked herself, "What don't we understand about our own citizens?" She flew back to Washington and gathered the relevant parties, all of whom might have claimed credit for a job well done, and asked them, "Is anyone here happy about the outcome?" To their credit and hers, no one was. Before she had been given her first paying job by the United States government, Kathy Sullivan had been put through a battery of tests. Some were physical, some were psychological, and others, well, she didn't know quite what they were. At no point during them had she figured out what her testers were looking for. She survived two virtually identical interviews with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, one with a good NASA cop, the other with a bad NASA cop. "The bad cop made you feel uncomfortable," she said. "The room was ill-lit. He sat behind the desk, and you sat in an exposed chair. You weren't facing each other. He was mumbling and not friendly." Then they did it all over again with a warm, sunny guy who was your best friend. Only much later did she learn that they wanted to see if she answered questions the same way, whether she was at ease or not. "I didn't have anything to compare it to," she said. "You might try to manipulate the system, but you need to know the system, and I didn't." Later, she decided that they weren't even really trying to figure out who she was. All they had wanted was the answer to a question. Will she be that same person that she appears to be now, when she is traveling at 17,500 miles per hour, 140 miles above Earth, and something goes bang? This was her first job interview, and she was applying to be an astronaut. It was 1977, but the work was still risky. "Every flight was still proving that you can get up there and come back alive," she said. "It's like riding bombs." Still, 8,078 other Americans had applied for the job. 5,608 of these had satisfied the basic job requirements. Of those, NASA invited 208 people to the Johnson Space Center outside Houston for a week of interviews. "They interviewed us in groups of 20," Kathy said. "I got there and saw this cluster of other people. It was all guys. That was okay. I'd been the only woman in a field camp and the only woman on a ship." The difference was that this wasn't just guys, but a club. My sense was a lot of these guys knew each other. They're fighter pilots or whatever. I'm 25, I'm a grad student, I'm broke. They seemed to be settled in and knew what they were doing, and I didn't. I thought, well, Catherine, enjoy the week. The main event was a 90-minute interview at a long table filled with strangers. One was the famously inscrutable head of the astronaut program, George Abbey. At the start, he leaned back in his chair, eyes half closed, and did not so much ask as mutter, "Tell us about yourself. Start with high school." That was it. Nothing more. It was deliberately underspecified, Kathy said. Telling people about herself wasn't her strong suit. "I've never been a self-revealing person," she said. She went ahead and told them about herself anyway. How by the age of 13 she'd learned from her father, an aerospace engineer, to fly a plane. How as a girl growing up in the 50s and 60s, she assumed that her ticket to adventure was not a pilot's license, but her gift for languages. Before she graduated from high school, without setting foot in France or Germany, she became fluent in both French and German. She planned to learn a bunch more languages. "My simple theory was learn lots of languages and use them to see the world," she recalled, in an oral history for the Johnson Space Center. She entered UC Santa Cruz in 1969 as a language major. But there was a science requirement, and to fulfill it, she took two classes in ocean science. There she learned that human beings were now descending 14,000 feet in tiny submarines and mapping the ocean floor. It was endlessly fascinating, this mix of things I'd always seen on the pages of National Geographic. The travel she'd imagined until then had been horizontal, east or west, north or south. She now began to imagine it as vertical, too, up and down. She wanted to study the plates beneath the bottom of the sea. She was accepted into graduate geology programs everywhere she applied, including Princeton, with full research fellowships. She accepted the free ride at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, because what interested her was the mountain range at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, known as the Mid-Ocean Ridge. And for several reasons, Nova Scotia seemed to her the best place to study it. From just about the moment she arrived, she started looking for access to a submarine that could take her down, so that she might inspect the Mid-Ocean Ridge up close. "I'm pursuing an academic career and asking, how do I get into one of those submarines? I wanted to go see the stuff myself." It was her brother who had first told her about NASA's new need for astronauts. He'd seen an ad in the newspaper announcing that the space agency was opening its rocket ships to all Americans between the ages of 25 and 40, under 6 feet tall, weighing less than 180 pounds, and in possession of just about any sort of college science degree. He'd already applied and thought she also should. Women were specifically encouraged for the first time, minorities too. All that was required were some character traits, a willingness to accept hazards comparable to those encountered in modern research airplane flights, a capacity to tolerate rigorous and severe environmental conditions, and an ability to react adequately under conditions of stress or emergency. Up to that moment, NASA had been looking mainly for test pilots who could at least feign indifference to their mortality. Now they were looking for scientists, or at any rate scientifically minded people, but with a twist. They needed the temperament of fighter jocks. Kathy hadn't taken her brother seriously. "You really think they're going to hire an oceanographer, a girl?" A few weeks later, she ran across the call for astronauts again, this time in a science journal. They really did seem to want women scientists, and she sensed that she might be the sort of woman they were looking for. "I never brought normal girl books home from the library," she recalled. "I was fascinated by maps and the stories they told." She was handy, too, and quick to figure out how things worked. "I kind of always flunked the Dahl's test," she told an interviewer for the Johnson Space Center's oral history project. "I never found the Dahls interesting. The dollhouse stuff I found interesting, but from an architectural point of view, building them. And I'd want to lay them out differently. I didn't want to just move the furniture around, and I sure didn't want to just sit there and imagine conversations between dolls that never happened. Let me go build another house. That was more interesting." The head of NASA's astronaut program had asked her to tell the group about herself. but she sensed that they were after something else, too. They listened without saying a word until she got to a point in her story where she was on a ship in the ocean, in a storm, conducting research. It was the aspect of research oceanography she loved best, figuring out how to adapt to everything that happens while you're at sea and still come back with the data that you needed and the accuracy that you needed. "I loved that challenge," she said.